Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Russell McIver of Single Payer Action, who explains why some advocates of single payer health care have decided that no reform legislation at all would be better than passage of President Obama's weakened health plan. Miriam Pemberton of the Institute for Policy Studies, who talks about a new report which concludes that the public interest would be served by redirecting military expenditures toward investments in climate security. And Father Luis Barrios, professor of Latin America and Latina Studies, who examines the ties between the U.S. Army's School for Latin American Soldiers and the leaders of the Honduran coup. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mohamed Yusuf, head of Nigerian radical sect Boko Haram, which seeks to impose strict Islamic law in northeastern Nigeria, was killed under mysterious circumstances in police custody. According to the BBC, Yusuf's bullet-ridden body was shown to local reporters just hours after he was captured by the police in the city of Madagari. Human rights monitors say Yusuf was the victim of an extrajudicial execution. Police insist the sect leader was killed in a shootout. Video obtained by the Associated Press showed Yusuf's body with gaping holes in his chest and his hands tied behind his back. Eric Golfschus of Human Rights Watch declared the extrajudicial killing of Yusuf in police custody is a shocking example of the brazen contempt of the Nigerian police for the rule of law. Nigerian security forces countered an offensive by Boko Haram that included attacks on police stations in five states and attacks on other government facilities. More than 700 people were killed in fighting between government forces and the sect. Amnesty International has charged Nicaragua's total ban on abortion as putting women and teenagers at risk in a country that already suffers from a high rate of maternal death. So far this year, 33 Nicaraguan women and girls have died in pregnancy, up from 20 during the same period last year. A medical review of 115 maternal deaths in 2007 showed 12 of these fatalities could have been prevented if therapeutic abortion was available. Nicaragua's new harsh penal law imposes prison sentences on women and girls who seek an abortion and stiff penalties for health providers who assist them. Doctors are now afraid to engage in aggressive treatment for cancer, HIV/AIDS, or heart conditions that can cause injury or death to an embryo or fetus. The penal code also overrules the Ministry of Health's obstetric rules and procedures that did permit therapeutic abortions in limited cases. Nicaragua's abortion ban was passed in the aftermath of the 2006 election won by Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega. Amnesty is seeking a repeal of Nicaragua's abortion ban and safe and accessible abortions for rape victims or when the life of the mother is at risk, and free speech protection for anyone speaking out against the abortion ban. Voters in Oakland, California, by a 3-to-1 margin, took the historic step to become the first municipality to tax marijuana through a new gross receipts tax that could raise $300,000 for the fiscally troubled city. Dale Geringer, the California coordinator for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, told the Christian Science Monitor, the voters of Oakland sent a message to the nation that cannabis is better treated as a legitimate tax-paying business than a cause of crime and feudal law enforcement expenditures. Since the passage of California Proposition 218 in 1996, marijuana has been available by prescription to relieve chronic pain and nausea. The drug is obtained in a growing number of buyers' clubs in the state. Currently, there are 4 buyers' clubs in Oakland. Although federal law prohibits the use and sale of marijuana, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says the federal government has halted raids of buyers' clubs in states that have legalized medical marijuana. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos Poplowski.
As President Obama admitted to failing at his stated goal of having the House and Senate pass health care reform legislation before the congressional August recess, Republicans, the health insurance industry, and other opponents of reform stepped up their efforts to derail legislation. Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, groups that planned the April 15th anti-Obama tea parties around the U.S., are now spearheading what many label as the AstroTurf organizing of healthcare reform opponents to disrupt congressional town hall meetings sponsored by legislators in their home districts during the August break. While the Senate has not hammered out a final health care reform bill, conservative Blue Dog Democrats in the House succeeded in weakening bills that have made it out of committee. They worked hard to cut back subsidies, consumer protections, and erode the core elements of a government-run public option to compete against private insurance companies. The health and insurance industries are spending more than $1.4 million a day to derail strong reform legislation, and Republicans and conservative Democrats who are doing their bidding are the beneficiaries, receiving large campaign contributions as a reward. Advocates of a single-payer health insurance plan, the model used in most industrialized nations of the world, have been disappointed that their favorite solution to America's failed healthcare system has not been seriously debated, and unhappy with the bills coming out of Congress. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Russell Mochaber, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter and founder of the group Single Payer Action. He explains why some of those who favor single payer have decided that no reform legislation at all would be better than passage of President Obama's weakened hybrid health plan, preferring to start the legislative process again from scratch.
Well, there are a group of 85 members of the House who support single-payer bill, H.R. 676. They are all Democrats. And unfortunately, it's not a real serious effort. And it's not a real serious effort because, unlike the Blue Dogs, this is why the Blue Dogs get all the attention, because the Blue Dogs, even though they're a much smaller group, they say, unless you meet our demands, we are not going to vote for the Obama plan. And the single-payer advocates have never said that. The single-payer advocates say, we prefer single-payer, but it's not going to happen, therefore we're going to go for a public plan and the unspoken final clauses, which is going to fail, and eventually we're going to get single-payer. And so the Obamacare is going to fail because Obamacare is a minor public plan that will add costs, as it's doing in Massachusetts. It's a very similar plan, require everybody to buy health insurance from the private and for-profit insurance companies. So it's a bailout for the health insurance companies. It does nothing to control costs because it keeps the health insurance companies in the game. Therefore, it keeps that layer of $400 billion in administrative costs there, and costs continue to escalate. So Obamacare is not going to happen. Now, I do not trust the Democrats and what they're doing in the Congress. They favor single payer, but it's not going to happen. Therefore, we have to have a public plan. The miscalculations the Democrats make in taking this tack of public plan instead of single payer, they thought that they could buy off the health insurance industry. This was the deal they cut with the devil. They went to Karen Ignani, who heads the American Health Insurance Plans, which is the health insurance industry, and they said to her, Karen, we can't afford you coming after us the way you went after the Clinton plan 20 years ago or so, so we want you on board. And she says, I will come on board if you do not do single payer. And they said, okay, we won't do single payer. We'll do a modified public plan, a very small, weak public plan that won't challenge your authority. And so that's the deal that they cut with them, and they thought that this would calm the waters and get passage. What they didn't calculate was that there's a rabid right-wing constituency that's going to attack anything the Democrats do, including a public plan. And they're going after the right-wing is going after the public plan with sort of a wink from the health insurance industry. I think the best that can happen this year is that Obamacare failed and then we start from scratch, as the president says. I'd prefer single payer if we were starting from scratch. Well, our view is let's start from scratch. And let's remember also, Scott, that President Obama in 2003, when he was a state senator in Illinois, said that he favors single payer and that the only way we're going to get it is we have to take back the White House and the Congress. Well, we've taken back the White House and the Congress, or at least he has and the Democrats have, and now they've backed off from single payer.
Russell, we seem to have a long-running syndrome in this country where working people in particular are convinced by mega million-dollar TV ad campaigns and direct mail and all the rest of the things put out there to convince people to vote against their own economic self-interest. And it's true, of course, in this debate, that a lot of people are being frightened into believing that anything that the government runs will take away their choice of physicians, that a single-payer healthcare plan would not work, and that somehow it's failed in Canada and Western Europe when the evidence certainly is to the contrary. How do grassroots organizations like yours overcome this well-financed propaganda campaign, which has certainly frightened the Democrats into not being upfront that single-payer is the most economically viable option?
Well, the way we do it is through direct confrontation. A lot of groups, they do, you know, email campaigns and writing letters and phone calls. We don't do that. Single-payer action activists from around the country are confronting this August the Democratic leadership, their members of Congress, their Republican members of Congress, and saying it's too late now, 60 Americans are dying every day. We can't afford a 1,000-page bill that nobody understands that creates a Rube Goldberg device that's going to fail, that's going to bankrupt the country, that's not going to cover everyone. We want a simple answer that works.
Somebody asked the question recently on a cable TV news show, where are all the activists who should be out there pushing for single payer, given that the right wing is now mobilizing to disrupt these congressional town hall meetings? The idea being that if there really was a public support for single payer, like some of the polls tell us, there should be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets demanding it and making President Obama and the Democratic Congress do it. And in the absence of that, some people say maybe there isn't the groundswell support for it.
Well, I believe in the step-by-step theory of democracy, that you have to crawl before you walk and walk before you run. And so we're starting to do it. So it's not true that it's not being done. It is being done. They're not tens of thousands of people. But it is an uphill struggle. It's not an easy task. There are a lot of people who are bought into the Democratic Party who don't want to fight the Democrats on this when we're focusing on the Democrats because they're the ones who are the problem. So a lot of single-payer supporters say, yes, we can't do it, but we believe in single-payer, but we have to support the Democratic Party and we have to support Obama. Our view is we can't take that position because it's our job to ensure that we bring that number of 60 dead a day down to zero. And the only way you do that is passing single-payer. And again, we believe that single-payer is going to happen sooner rather than later. We want to make it happen sooner. So it's our job to bring people into the movement. We're actually getting a very good response from young people and all people of all ages who want to do this. I'm not a pessimist on this. I think that for this year, perhaps we'll have to defeat whatever Obama has planned, which is not going to work, and to start from scratch. And I still have hope that President Obama will take the lead here when this fails, if it fails, and come around to his 2003 position, which is single payer is the only way to go. All we have to do is take back the White House and the Congress and get it done. So he's done that. Let's get it done. Let's push through single payer.
That was Russell Mokyber, founder of the group Single Payer Action. Visit the group's website at singlepayeraction.org. Recent Pentagon analyses have targeted climate change as a major security threat, since increased flooding, droughts, and other climate challenges would likely increase tension and possibly ignite conflicts both across borders and within nations. The Obama administration has put more money into combating climate change than his predecessor, President Bush, but almost all the funding dedicated to that purpose is coming from the one-time federal stimulus spending package. President Obama has also increased overall military spending in his proposed 2010 budget, although the rate of increase isn't as high as that seen over the Bush years from 2001 to 2009. In fiscal year 2008, the U.S. government spent $88 on funding the military for every $1 spent on projects to stabilize the climate. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, about a new report she authored titled Military versus Climate Security, Mapping the Shift from the Bush Years to the Obama Era. The report concludes that the public interest would be served by narrowing the gap between military expenditures and investing in climate security, a policy shift that will create sustainable jobs.
The military and the intelligence communities are both now viewing climate change as a major potential source of increased violent conflict around the world. You know that when you have rising sea levels and in some places displacing people and droughts displacing them elsewhere, and you have a conflicts over scarce water resources, for example, the military and the intelligence communities see those as potential major security threats. And I haven't seen the Obama administration come out with its own studies on this subject, but I'm reasonably confident that they would agree, since they look at climate change as one of their major priorities and one of their major concerns.
You know, all along when I was reading this document about spending on climate change versus military spending, I'm thinking that the military sector is the nation's biggest contributor of greenhouse gases, which is directly related to climate change. Would you say if there's less spending on the military, then the emissions would go down? Or do you know if they're actively doing anything to reduce their carbon footprint?
Some departments in the military are doing things to reduce their emissions. They're doing it for their own reasons. They want ready source of power if, you know, some cyber attack knocks out all power across the United States. So they want to just be able to keep on going. And so they are investing in solar power and in electric vehicles that don't run out of gas in the middle of the desert, that kind of thing. But it's, you know, they have a long way to go. The solution to the problem is not just that the military green itself and convert to renewable energy sources. Really what I'm saying is because of the magnitude of this climate security problem, we do need to shift, you know, major resources from the military into measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Miriam Pemberton, your study also reviews what several previous studies have shown, that spending on the military creates fewer jobs per dollar than spending in other sectors. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
There have been studies done by economists showing that $1 billion in federal spending, if you put it into the military, it creates fewer jobs than if you put it into things like mass transit or healthcare or education. And so just sort of, a one-to-one comparison like that reveals that spending on climate change will create more jobs than spending on the military. But in addition, all military production is wholly financed by government expenditures. It's all public money. Whereas spending on climate change, on tax credits for businesses to weatherize or to purchase green vehicles, that's really public spending leveraging private spending. And so for that reason, in addition, spending on military production creates fewer jobs than climate change spending, because climate change spending is really leveraging private money, so is going to be creating a lot more privately funded jobs. And so, what we really need to do is look at if we're going to be reducing some expenditures on the military for weapon systems that we don't need, and the Obama administration is making an effort in that direction, there are going to be some jobs lost in the military sector. And so what the report does is look at some of the means that the government can employ to create new jobs and to sort of manage the transition from military production to green technology industries. And, it looks at direct investment, and it looks at tax incentives and technical assistance, green job retraining, all of the ways that the government can ease this transition.
That was Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Get a copy of the Military versus Climate Security Report by calling IPS at area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at ips-dc.org. More than a month after the Honduran Congress and military overthrew Manuel Zelaya, the democratically elected president of Honduras, diplomatic efforts continued to restore him to power. Costa Rican president and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Oscar Arias, was enlisted to try to negotiate Zelaya's return to Honduras. Mr. Arias has proposed that Manuel Zelaya be reinstated to the presidency with limited power, followed by early presidential elections. But thus far, the deal has been rejected by the de facto government in Honduras, headed by Roberto Micheletti. Zelaya attempted to return to Honduras by air 1 week after the coup, an effort blocked by the Honduran military at the Tegucigalpa airport. President Zelaya has also tried unsuccessfully to enter Honduras from an encampment set up by his supporters on the Nicaraguan border. The military prevented him from crossing the frontier, but did not arrest him as was threatened by the coup-installed government. Since the coup, the regime in power has repressed groups supporting Zelaya and arrested their leaders. Press reports assert that there have been assassinations, torture, and over 1,000 arrests. Independent media outlets opposed to the coup have been subjected to harassment and attempted closure. While the Obama administration has condemned the coup, the U.S. has not withdrawn its ambassador from the country. Washington has withheld $18.5 million in military aid, but has not cut off $180 million pledged to Honduras in development funds. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Father Luis Barrios, chair and professor of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Father Barrios, who recently served a 2-month sentence for committing nonviolent civil disobedience at a protest demanding the closure of the U.S. Army's Military School for Latin American Soldiers, talks about the connections between the Army's Western Hemisphere Institute for Security and Cooperation and the leaders of the Honduran coup.
The intention was to put Roberto Micheletti as the president, but in order to do this, they went into the head of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Romeo Orlando Vasquez Velasquez. He's been trained in the School of the America twice, and together with him, we have more militaries, because we need to understand that Honduras has been playing a very significant role for U.S. imperialism in Latin America. More specifically, with the Soto Cano base, it's a military base that is controlled by the USA government. It was the same place that they were doing all kinds of atrocities when the Sandinista government was in power in the 1980s in Nicaragua.
The Obama administration has come out foursquare against the coup d'etat in Honduras, but there are many who question their motives behind the scenes and some of the actions of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in dealing with this crisis. Can you give us your views on that?
Listen, when there's a coup in Latin America, nothing is going to happen with all these militaries if the USA embassy is not involved. So historically, this is a reality. You go back into what's going on in Latin America, and you're going to discover this. When you look at the performance that Hugo Jordans, who is the USA ambassador to Honduras, a Cuban-American, who now he recognized that he was in a meeting where they were planning to overthrow Zelaya. So Hugo Jordans is not going to do things like this without consulting with the President of the United States, which is Obama. Hillary Clinton knew about this. Obama knew about this. So that means that the White House was aware, the Pentagon was aware, the Congress was aware, because they've been putting money. And the whole issue was to stop the referendum that was going to happen in Honduras. It was more a consultation to the people to do an amendment to the Constitution of Honduras, which is a democratic process. But again, you have at least three players in Honduras that they've been blessed by the Obama administration and before the Obama administration, Bush and the other people. One is the ruling class in Honduras. The second is the leadership of the church, and this includes not only the Catholic Church, but also the Protestant Church. And then you have the militaries. But these three together, similar to what happened in Venezuela, similar to what happened in Brazil, in Paraguay, in Argentina, in Chile, always these two groups, they're going to function only if the USA government gives them the authorization to do it. the Obama administration is doing is playing a double standard here, openly saying, I'm against the coup. Okay? The Elijah is the president. But you listen to what he's saying, but what else is doing? Nothing. He then went into negotiating with those people who did the coup. You do not negotiate with these people. So they've been killing time. It's already more than 1 month after June 28th, killing time, and now they're running a campaign to discredit President Zelaya in the middle of this operation. So the media is playing an incredible role in this panic that they're creating all over the places.
Father Barrios, what specifically is John McCain's involvement vis-a-vis his organization, the International Republican Institute, which gets its money from the National Endowment for Democracy? Do we know if he's involved in any way, shape, or form in this coup d'etat?
Well, until at this moment, we're saying that, yes, he's involved. It's the same issue when before the elections in Nicaragua, that they were running campaigns against the Sandinista government. They did the same in El Salvador, so they're very scared. So they knew that Zelaya was going to win the referendum, so they said we need to stop this before he wins the referendum because the amendment to the Constitution is going to happen. So these people, and it's something that we need to understand, these right-wing organizations are very well organized. They're very united. We need to learn from them, okay? And on top of that, they have the money. The National Endowment for Democracy, this is the cornerstone, okay? It's not the CIA anymore after Iran contract, so they just, you know, clearing the face of the USA foreign policy. And the National Endowment for Democracy is the one playing all these atrocities. And John McCain, my friend, he's one of the leaders in this coup.
That was Father Luis Barrios, Chair and Professor of Latin America and Latina Studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at the City University of New York, and an activist with School of the Americas Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at soaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Poplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.